Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the world's largest democracy, India, is holding national elections, which will decide its leaders for the next 5 years. What is the state of India's democracy and what are its big challenges? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Beginning on April 19th and running through the month of May, India is conducting its national elections. These elections come in light of rising Indian power and of particularly important issues that face the nation. It's the fifth largest economy in the world. It surpassed France and quite notably its former colonizer, Great Britain. It's the largest nation in the world, surpassing China in population, and its democracy has been intact since independence. So this rising world power and largest democracy faces challenges of economic growth, advancing its power, and perhaps most importantly, concerns that some of its democratic practices might be backsliding under its Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. On today's show, we discuss the Indian elections, its constitution, how a nation of 1.4 billion carries out an election, what some of the likely outcomes are, and what this means for India's future. Our panel today is Amit Ahuja, who is an associate professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara. He's the author of Mobilizing the Marginalized, Ethnic Parties Without Ethnic Movements. Sandipto Dasgupta is assistant professor of politics at the New School for Social Research. He's the author of Legalizing the Revolution, India and the Constitution of the Post-Colony. And Ritu Mather is a new full professor of international relations at the University of Texas, San Antonio. She's the author of Civilization Discourses and Weapons Control. Thank you all very, very much for joining us. And Amit, I'll start with you. The Indian elections at this point, it seems, everything I've read seems like the BJP, the party in power, is going to return to power. What ultimately have been some of the issues that India has faced? And has there been any sort of shift in politics from previous elections to this one?
So firstly, thank you for inviting me to this conversation. If I understand correctly, is you basically looking for what are the shifts from the previous elections in this one? Is it?
Yeah, if there has been any shifts. Yeah.
I think in terms of the issues, you know, in some ways there is a fair amount of continuity that we see when we think about what's in play, what issues are in play. But the tone of the elections has been interesting if we see the past two elections, 2014 and 2019, in which the BJP came out in front. In 2014, it was a campaign that launched Mr. Modi as a prime ministerial candidate in across the nation. And, you know, in some ways, you know, it was an election in which the most of the tone of the BJP was very inclusive. The idea of sabka saath, sabka vikas, you know, everybody together and a development for everyone. And so this shifted a little bit into 2019, where because of the skirmish with Pakistan and a terrorist attack in India, there was a more militarized nationalist rhetoric. And in this one, we've really sort of seen a mixed bag. There is caste, communalism, development, all the issues have been in place. So there's no one uniform binding theme in that regard. Where there is a continuity, interestingly, is to see how much, the issues of caste and religion are in play. You could have opened the newspapers from 50 years ago and looked at what issues are there in a parliamentary election, and you would have found that caste and religion dominate. And it's something similar this time. So, of course, the demands have morphed, they've changed over time. But in general, the fact that these themes have survived just tells you how much they still matter in Indian society and how Indian politics is organized.
And Sandipto, I know that India's faced these challenges, the challenges of being perhaps the most religiously diverse country in the world, and caste, class, those questions as well. And I know that the country, upon its founding, tried to address these concerns constitutionally. First of all, how did they try to address those concerns? And has it been largely successful, or, you know, have there been some real cleavages?
Thank you for having me. The issue of course, religious ethnic divide, it's baked into the country's birth itself, which is born of a very, very bloody partition on religious lines. And that sort of, you know, had this effect in Indian politics, which never really fully went away. So this has been an underlying theme. Now, however, the governing party, or the Party of Independence, which is the Indian National Congress, was officially and remains officially a secular party. It refused to bind to this two-nation idea of India for Hindus and Pakistan for Muslims. That was official policy, which was sort of reflected more or less in the constitutional vision, which was, it's a secular document, very clearly there are clear sort of, you know, articles for non-discrimination, clear articles and sort of, you know, making sure that the state is not in any way inflected by any kind of majoritarian political leanings. However, the politics itself and the party itself, even the Congress from the very beginning, these questions, especially of, you know, majority Hindu politics, was there in it. So it had sort of this weird separation of a certain group of Congress people, including Jawaharlal Nehru, who was the first Prime Minister of India, who was avowedly secular, and there was a modernist sort of wing, which was more or less running the government. And then at the local levels of the party, these questions sort of remained. And so the constitution, institutionally, India remains a very, very secular country. It has, you know, all these whole host of different sort of rights, which, and, you know, mechanisms to address that. But the politics never fully rid itself of that, of those divides, whether that's of religion. Caste is a whole different question, because caste is even more sort of baked into the politics from the very beginning. So that would be the answer in terms of, and we can talk more about, I think, but I do think there's a qualitative shift between then and now, even if we say there are these questions have always been there, and there's a quite an enormous qualitative shift then and now, and that's basically the fact that the ruling party, or the, you know, the governing class, is bent on using the majoritarian politics quite explicitly and quite institutionally, and those two are quite new. So in other words, doing it very, very openly in their rhetoric and their actions, as well as trying to sort of in some ways bake it into the legal institutional framework. And that's an extraordinarily large shift in Indian history as such.
That's fascinating, because I mean, what you're saying, I think, is that India constitutionally is secular and constitutionally has gotten rid of caste, whatever that means. It's one thing to do it legally. It's another to realize it politically and socially. And Ritu Mather, I want to bring you in, because I know the current Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, gets described in the West as being a Hindu nationalist representing Hindu identity. And that's been some of the concerns we hear about backsliding. Is that a fair description of Modi? And is that where he's drawing, you know, his incredible popularity with the expectation he's going to win?
Thanks, Doug, for inviting me to this conversation. I love talking and chatting about India, so I will always be a part of this kind of a conversation. With regard to your two comments, I want to make first observations. First is, like, when we, your opening remarks about democratic practices backsliding under Modi in India. So the first thing is that, is this really a statement? Is it an assumption? Is it a question? Right. That is very, very important to keep that in mind. Second thing is also how we as scholars, as practitioners located even outside India, how we frame our questions, because I understand that there's always this thing about Modi labeling, you know, so whether it's basically, are the institutional practices in India declining and is it becoming an issue of personality based politics coming into foray? But it's also because, in a sense, how we also frame our questions, we always make it Modi centric kind of questions. And then when we make it so personality-centric kind of questioning, in a sense, that takes away our own capacity, in a sense, to question the institution-building practices within India itself. Modi is a nationalist, right? And yes, he has his, you know, origins coming back from the RSS organization, etc. But you see, over a period of time, Modi has also expanded and grown as a leader. Right, so he's no longer just a leader who can only be described as a Hindu nationalist. He's actually a leader now who's mobilizing an entire country. And he's mobilizing an entire country also because of what he has accomplished in terms of delivering the economic goods which the Indian population has been decrying for, you know, for a long period of time. So I think how we frame the issues with regard to the Indian politics itself, if we frame them in terms of a personality, then yes, Modi's you know, name keeps coming to the forefront more and more. But in terms of if we actually look at the developmental agenda, if you look at the other aspects of institution building, etc., then that also will help us in addressing these questions in a much more fair manner.
And Rita, I'm going to stay with you for a moment, and because this question about democratic backsliding, first of all, whether it's Modi-centric or whether it's institutional or whatever, I'm going to say the concerns about the future of the democracy, because it's too alarmist to say India will not be democratic. But certain democratic practices seem to be moving in a less democratic way. And first of all, is that an accurate description? And secondly, is that more of an institutional question within India? Is it a question about the development of the political system? Or if so, what's driving it?
Okay, just going back into history, right? Most of the countries who emerged after the colonial era, right? They emerged as one-party states, right? Whether it was Kenya, whether it was India, there was always a dominance of one party. And even India, when it was ruled by the Congress for several decades, right? It was the leadership which played a very, very important role, whether it was Mrs. Indira Gandhi or whether it was Nehru, etc. So this is so, even now that another party is in power and Modi is playing this, like, you know, the at the helm of the figure, like Indira Gandhi, in a sense, that is very much an important issue, like in terms of, yes, he is the one who's leading at the forefront. The problem over here, in a sense, arises is in terms of, like, when Indira Gandhi was in power, did it, in a sense, decimate Indian political institutions? Yes, we saw that in terms of the emergency being, played out in India, and then the electorate basically sending her back. In the case of Modi so far, we have not seen in terms of any kind of emergency. So in terms of how the institutions are being eroded, in a sense, that strategy, in a sense, has to be understood a little bit more differently. Because in terms of, yes, the one party has been a dominant party in India. That has been the fate of Indian politics for several decades. India has also, the Indian democratic system, how we understand it from the American democratic system, is very, very different. India is a federal country, but Indian federalism is different from the American federalism, right? So when we use terms like democracy, when we use terms like secularism, we also have to understand that these concepts are not, they are universal, but the meanings associated with them have to be different in different contexts. So, for example, recently, like, you know, when the American president issued a statement with regard to the Indian population, in a sense that Indians are what called xenophobic, right? That, in a sense, sends a backlash to the Indian people that how much do you know actually about our country, right? India is a diverse country. India has been invaded many, many times. Indian population is very, very diverse. But in a sense, to keep using the caste, the religion stick, in a sense, to keep India in check in some ways, right? To make India answerable in those terms. So make Indians answer in terms of a language in which the West wants to understand India is also very, very problematic, right? So that is what I would like to, in a sense, focus about, how the West also should engage with India, how the West also, what kind of questions they should frame in terms of understanding India is very, very important. And this is also the case with many other countries. For example, Turkey also was a very diverse country, right? But the growing populism, which you see in many other countries, that also has to be, in a sense, understood in a global context. Because the war on terror, the concern with regard to the Muslim population, how they were being treated, did not just start with the population internal dynamics within India. It started also with the wars which were being waged in India's neighborhood, right? And that also had its implications in terms of what kind of insecurities arose within the population itself, and how those also presented opportunities to the different political parties to, you know, shift their agenda and make it more, you know, religion-centric in some ways.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the Indian elections and the challenges, the political issues that India faces. Our guests today are Amit Ahuja of UC Santa Barbara, Sandipto Dasgupta of the New School, and Ritu Mather of the University of Texas, San Antonio. And Amit, since Ritu had raised these questions about diversity and broadly the way in which that we try to understand diversity in the Indian context, I know you've written quite a bit on ethnic parties and what this question about ethnicity means within the Indian context. The first question is it similar to the way in which we view the ethnic identity and diversity, you know, in other countries? And how has that played out throughout Indian history within its democracy and the creation of some of these political parties?
What the West thinks really will not matter for a country as big as this India. It's a very vibrant country when it comes to forces that have mobilized over a period of time. You know, because it's diverse, ethnically, religiously, class-wise, linguistically, just the range of diversity is really mind-boggling. Conversations on diversity have been ongoing. These are across regional divides, linguistic divides. These are across the divide of social hierarchy through the caste system. As was mentioned earlier, there's been a long-standing religious conversation. Who does India belong to in terms of its religious composition? These have been there. They have not always resulted in the emergence of ethnic or linguistic or caste-based parties. At times, that has happened. But you know, if you think about the party system and how it's evolved, what large parties, especially national parties, have tried to do is to appeal to different groups at the same time to bring to build large coalitions. And this is where I think in some ways also this, you know, the rise, the emergence of the BJP, for example, since 2014 as a dominant player is in Indian electoral politics is actually really illustrative of this. Until 2014, BJP was an active player in Indian politics. It's been a national party, but its vote share was stuck around 20% or so. What begins to happen is at this time is the BJP very deliberately goes out there and reaches out to voters, you know, a broad cross section of voters, especially the lower castes, in ways it had not done earlier. And so its caste coalition today is much bigger. It draws many more members of the lower caste. And that's why, and that is reflected in its larger vote share since 2014. Narendra Modi is an example of that. He does not belong to the upper caste. For the longest time, the BJP was viewed as an upper caste only party. The upper caste still vote for it. In very large numbers. In fact, it is their most popular choice in elections, but they are not the only ones responsible for BJP's electoral success. And where BJP is different from its predecessor, as it, you know, when it comes to a dominant party, for the longest time, Congress was India's dominant party. It was the party of freedom struggle. Congress was caste as well as religiously inclusive. Where BJP is different from the Congress is not so much on the caste dimension, but on the religious dimension, where the BJP philosophy of Hindu nationalism singles out Muslims, and you know, it has not reached out to them in the same way it has reached out to newer groups in other cross sections, in different parts of India, and also in terms of the caste coalitions that it's building. Some of this is beginning to change, but I'd still want to see more evidence of that, especially when the data is available for this election. So for example, they have made an effort to reach out to lower caste Muslims, and I'd be curious to see if they have had success in terms of increasing their vote share among Muslims after this election.
Ritu Mather, I wanted to respond as well.
Yeah, just very quickly once. Just 2 points very quickly. First thing is with regard to the diversity of the Muslim population within India itself, right? Because there is also within the Muslims in India, there is a diverse population. They got Shia, Sunnis, and Bohra Muslim population. And also in terms of where are the concentration of this population, right? So there is a large concentration in Gujarat, and there's also a large concentration in Bengal. Right now, the BJP has been in power in Gujarat for several years. That was Modi's bastion, and the Bora community, Muslim community in India, actually has very good relations with the BJP party because it's also a business community. So that is very, very important to keep that in mind. And Modi's popularity also and growth within the Muslim community is based from his relationship with the Bora community. Now, if you look at Bengal is also a border state. Bengal is controlled by the Trinamool TMC, Mamata Banerjee party. And if you go into Bengal, and recently I was there in India in January, and I grew up in Calcutta in Bengal, and I also studied in North, and this year I even traveled to the western parts of India. And if you actually go back to Bengal, that entire sense of stagnation which is there, and that sense of, oh, Muslims are not part of the society in a sense, is actually stemming from that part of India in a sense. That sense of decadence, that sense of stagnation, that sense of differences in terms of keeping them, this thing, playing the religious politics with regard to giving, the Muslims certain benefits which would not be given by the state to other communities, etc. So within India also, to understand how the Muslim population and which segment of the Indian population is being played, Muslim population is being played, is very, very important to understand that, because the politics of Bengal is very different from the politics in Gujarat. And the level of economic development which has taken place in Gujarat and in western part of India compared to the eastern part of India is a completely different story. Like even after 20 years, when you go back to Bengal, there is nothing moving. In fact, it's only just going back all the time again. The second point I just want to make very quickly is also, I agree with Amit that yes, the Indian population is very important because they are very articulate, they have a voice, and their voice will be decisive in these elections. So the West's representation of India and their impact on India might be a little bit different. But over here, I would also like to say that the Indian population is also a highly educated population and a very dynamic population, and it listens to the news, etc., much more regularly than in the West. In fact, the Indian population knows much more about the West than the West knows about India, right? And it is because of this, when these kind of statements are issued by Biden and other Western leaders, that plays a very, very important role in terms of how the Indian political leaders, as well as in how the Indian public itself responds, and makes this also an important point of contention with regard to how we need to stand up, how we need to have a voice on the international stage. And this is only possible if we have a strong party and a strong leader on the international stage also.
I will note that absolutely. I think it's fair to say that Indians know more about what's going on in the West than the West knows what's going on in India, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to record this show. Sandipto, part of what seems to be going on here, and this is probably true of any democratic country, that not only are the internal politics what's really driving elections, but regions, states. In the United States, of course, so much attention gets paid to, which states, what are the battleground states, what are those areas. And what I'm getting from this is that India, perhaps even more so than in the US and a number of other countries, that politics really is quite regional. One of the things I do know about India is that the national parties tend to have alliances with the local parties. So is this just generally a feature of Indian federalism, where you have the local parties and then they make the alliances with the national parties? And how much is that defining where India is currently politically and the likely outcomes of this election?
Thank you very much. I think that's a really important question which we come to, right? Like, India is not the country, it's a continent. It's in terms of languages, and not just in terms of the diversity, as we say regularly, but it really is deep-rooted different sort of cultures which in any other context would be a country and so on. Now, so the history of this is, of course, the country is united through the freedom movement against British rule, right? And so when you have, when Congress comes out of the International Congress as the party of independent struggle, it is a genuinely pan-Indian party, right? And it is able to mobilize and have electoral victories across the country. And that sort of remains for about 20 years. And from 1970s, you see, for complex reasons, which we don't have time to go into, the fracturing of that started happening, right? And it's not always necessarily in from the new parties, it's within Congress at the fracturing. And by sort of 80s, 90s, you have the emergence of what you call regional parties, which are parties based on, so the India based in different provinces. The provinces are generally drawn, the borders are drawn on based of language. There was a linguistic sort of, reorganization of the country from the earlier British divisions. And so you have these regional parties, which are often sort of, you know, regional language-based parties, and often they were fighting against the Congress as a national party, right? So that was sort of, and then there was, of course, the left party, another pan-Indian formation. And the BJP has sort of now tried to replace Congress as the pan-Indian party. The problem, though, is for BJP, and this is a very, very important distinction, that BJP is still predominantly a northern and western Indian party, right? It's sort of its base, its history goes to those. And the northern Indian is the most important one. That's the Gangetic Plains, where the most Indians live. So that's the huge, that's, there's a massive chunk of population and therefore electoral votes there. So therefore winning that is very, very important. Congress is unable to win any seats there for a while now, and BJP kind of controls that region and also the Western India, right? Where it is much, much less successful is in the east and the south of the country, right? So I think Ritu already mentioned, so if you look at the map of India from Bengal all the way down through Telangana and then Tamil Nadu, Kerala, and only in Karnataka they have had sometimes have been in power, but everybody else they have in other parts of India where they haven't been able to have massive electoral success. So they have been trying and they have made headways in recent years, right? And so this is that's a very important distinction between BJP of now and Congress of old. And that also matters, I think, in some ways culturally. The way we talk about diversity among sort of Muslims in India, Hinduism is extraordinary. It's not even, you know, it's not in a religion in the traditional sense. There's no, you know, there's no one book, there's no one church. It's made of a really complex set of regional cultural practices. There are different goddesses and gods in different parts of India, different rituals, of course, different caste hierarchies, right? Now, BJP, again, in their version of Hinduism, is primarily, again, a sort of a northern Indian, with some mixture of Western Indian Hindu practices and the kind of the gods they use, Ram, which has been sort of the major political sort of figure, divine political figure they've used, is primarily a god of, or the version of it is a god of North India. And so there has been that, and that's this kind of to all, and so there's an attempt, and it's an interesting attempt, the first time in history, to sort of create a version of a pan-Indian religious majoritarianism. So if Congress had a pan-Indian appeal based on its independence struggle, right? And sort of a big kind of buy-in of elites from different parts of the parts of regional elites in different parts. The attempt of BJPs, which is, you know, quite successful in some ways so far, but not yet fully, is to create a pan-Indian identity, which is based upon Hinduism and a very particular version of Hinduism, right? So that's, I think, partly what also is playing out is some of the most powerful challenges to BJP electorally are not necessarily the Congress, the national party, but these regional parties, the ones who have had the most consistent success against them electorally, are the ones who have been able to sort of mobilize a regional identity against this national identity, right? And Tamil Nadu is perhaps the most sort of successful example of that in the South.
When we come back, although Western commentators have focused on India's ethnicity and democracy, they're missing important facets in the country's politics. What are those? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. With its 1.4 billion population and a billion registered voters, India stands as the world's largest democracy and its fifth largest economy. What are the roles of its institutions in supporting democracy, and how are their elections conducted? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Amit Ahuja of UC Santa Barbara, Sandipto Dasgupta of the New School, and Ritu Mather of the University of Texas, San Antonio. Sandipo, I'll ask you first, but I'm going to ask all the panelists this question. Conducting an election in a nation this size, it's physically, logistically a challenge. And one thing that always strikes me is it takes place over 6 weeks. What are some of India's political practices that differ from, you know, in the US and other places in the West in actually conducting an election of this size?
I think the main difference, of course, which everyone notices correctly, is the phased nature of it, right? So it's a, you know, you have these five or six stage elections, mostly because of manpower and ability, sort of because, you know, to kind of organize elections successfully in these different regions, given the, you know, the number of voters on the rolls. And then sort of, you know, sort of releasing the results at the very, very end, so that it doesn't, one phase result doesn't, you know, in any way sway the voters to vote some way or the other, right? So that's the kind of the major point of difference. But there are other some interesting ones, lesser known ones, I mean, which other post-colonial countries have followed from India. One, for example, the fact that they use electoral symbols. So every party is given a particular symbol, and that's because there was a large population which it was not couldn't read. So you have to sort of be identifying parties for voting in the ballots. So that's one sort of, you know, and another one, which I think we should mention, and then it's been a point of contention this particular election, and again, something which was widely sort of, you know, revered and followed across the post-colonial world, is the creation, which US does not have, a creation of an independent electoral commission, right? In other words, an independent body, appointed body, made of former bureaucrats generally. It has a very small staff, but it has a lot sort of, and it has a kind of a constitutional sort of autonomy, which has sort of been reinforced by case law in subsequent decades. And it sort of takes over and, you know, orders different state governments to act in certain ways to ensure neutrality and fairness in polls, as opposed to in America, where the relevant state governments, organize the polls. And that has been a very, very important point, and it has, you know, been a fact of India, which they have sort of exported that expertise across the world, precisely because of how important that is. That's one institution which this particular year has been under question. So that institution also sort of does much more than just run the elections, right? They also ensures in what's called a model code of conduct. They kind of say what the kind of stuff you can or cannot say, the kind of nature of the political ads, funding, and so on and so forth, right? And that has been under quite a significant question this particular year for certain kinds of things they, both things they haven't done, mostly things they haven't done, which they normally would have done, and certain things they have done. And that there are some matters of, you know, there are a bunch of Supreme Court cases going along as we speak on that question, including to do with, you know, Prime Minister's own speech against, you know, sort of playing on the communal divide, or sort of, you know, releasing some basic data about the elections that already been happened. And also there are questions about the way the current election commissioners were appointed, which sort of, that's how it sort of, you know, flows from. So when you talk about sort of democratic backsliding, this is one very, very important point, because there, of course, in India, there's always been sort of governmental overreach or local violences and, you know, communal riots. Those are things that are not entirely a new feature, but there were certain kind of institutions which did have a broad public trust, including broad trust amongst opposition, which is an extremely important point. And if you listen to much of the opposition, not just one, but across the country, there are, and they're, you know, quite vocal about their lack of faith in the Electoral Commission, which I think has a, you know, problematic sort of element for going forward for in the democracy and its health. And because, you know, you don't just need to have election, but you should have to trust the results and the process and that. And that has severely weakened amongst the opposition parties.
Richa Mather, that seems to suggest then a point you made earlier in the show about how much these concerns get laid at the feet of the prime minister and of the ruling party. Because if you're talking about general concerns about legitimacy of an electoral commission, and I imagine some of those, these accusations of being biased, a lack of fairness with that, inevitably that would seem to blow back on whoever is in power. Is that fair to say that? So some of the accusations against the BJP are simply because they are the party in power where we've got these concerns about legitimacy. But is the Electoral Commission unbiased?
Yes, the Electoral Commission is basically a free and autonomous body in a sense. But recently, as Sudipto was trying to bring attention to it, in a sense, there have been certain changes in the way basically appointments were taking place. And there was also certain concerns with regard to the election bonds. Because what is happening over here is that one of the problems, I think, is how the BJP in its strategy of making India a modern, developed India is trying to borrow from the US model of elections and US model of crafting the economy. It is trying to put that into place in India, in a sense, and that is creating a certain degree of problem. So that obviously has to be questioned and debated. Another point also is with regard to with the opposition itself, you know, because opposition also is trying to use every possible leverage it can, in a sense, to gain some mileage, whether it is with regard to using the, you know, the electronic machines, you know, which have been a staple now of Indian elections, and, you know, Rahul Gandhi making some comments about, you know, electronic machines cannot be trusted, etc. So these kind of questions, and yes, the question with regard to electoral bonds was very, very important, which the opposition could have raised earlier, in a sense, and which could have been brought into the court system, so that a little bit with regard to the money flowing into this electoral process could have actually been questioned, and because otherwise the BJP stands to benefit from that. I think that should have definitely been taken into account. But another aspect also of this is how the opposition also is, because it knows that the Western audiences are much more susceptible to using claims around ethnicity, religion, caste divide, etc. And so they also use this language, in a sense, right, to often, in a sense, gain leverage for themselves. But if you look at it within the domestic political system, whether it is the Congress, whether it is the Aam Aadmi Party, right, they have lost their own credibility because of their own actions within the Indian public. Right, Arvind Kejriwal recently was basically put behind bars. There's a huge cases going on against his entire political party in the spectrum. TMC Mamata Banerjee, you know, there are cases with regard to her political party being, you know, in Bengal. How they, when the Enforcement Directorate tried to go over there, how they were beaten with sticks, etc. How women of Sandarkhali were not allowed to speak up, etc. So because they have, and if you look at their agenda is really not a, so it is not that, oh, the political party is in dominance. Yes, it is in dominance. And the dominance is, the unfortunate part is that the opposition itself does not enjoy any kind of credibility or legitimacy within the Indian public itself. And their agenda is only of what they will undo with regard to what the BJP has done. It is nothing in terms of what they will do in terms of actually crafting, in terms of addressing the people's needs. Only, oh, BJP has done this, we are going to crash this out. BJP is done, we are going to crash this out. So that language in itself is not appealing to the Indian public.
And Amit, I want to bring you in as well about the questions about the concerns for backsliding. So what do you see as some of the core questions, some of the core concerns, and, you know, what's driving some of this lack of confidence in the part of certainly some Indians in the political system?
Doug, if I may, I'm going to come to this question, but I just want to lay out, if it's okay, just the scale of the elections in India. You know, we talked about the fact that it's spread over, you know, many weeks. It happens in phases. But we're talking close to 1 billion registered voters, 5 million voting machines, 1 million polling stations, about 15 million personnel who are required to conduct this election over the different phases. That is a massive exercise. And, you know, in some ways, to be able to pull that off, you know, is something that really does differentiate India from elections, democratic elections that are held elsewhere. Also, what is different, especially, you know, if you think about the sort of conversations we've been having in this country, is that, you know, despite political disagreements, polarization at the state level, sometimes at the national level, there hasn't been a moment where electoral results have been rejected by the losing side. And so there has been a peaceful transfer of power, and both sides have accepted the electoral results. Now, let me sort of come to the backsliding issue, because I think, you know, I think the one thing that we don't sometimes think about is in terms of the institutional features here. In India, the strong executive has traditionally had the powers to bend the state and state institutions to their will. And when we've had strong executives, essentially when we've had parties with very substantial or, you know, very comfortable parliamentary majorities, we have seen the executive dominate the institution. Some of those institutions which are referee institutions, at times institutions which are related to checks and balances. We've seen this during Indira Gandhi's rule in the 1970s and the 80s and under Rajiv Gandhi. And what sometimes when, especially when Indians sometimes think about democratic backsliding, one change that they're noticing, is not so much just the backsliding issue. It's actually how the political structure has changed somewhat. We are coming off, in 2014, India comes off a 30-year period of coalition governments. And that's a 30-year period of weak executive that allows referee institutions like the Election Commission, like the judiciary, to accumulate power and to act based on what their mandate is. And in certain places, as some of the work that I've done shows, even expand their mandate. So we think about Indian elections being conducted in phases. That was not always the case, by the way. If you go back to the 1980s, elections are wrapped up in a week's time. If you go back to the early elections and if you sort of see how elections, this entire story of phased elections starts in the 1990s. When the Election Commission takes it upon itself to suggest that, look, for the reasons of security, for having freer and fair elections, where polling stations can be secured, we need to move security forces. Therefore, we need to hold these elections in phases. And the government, agrees. That's just one example. And now that we have, since 2014, a strong executive, we are beginning to see some of the stresses that referee institutions feel. The Election Commission being one of them, and the Model Code of Conduct in some ways is actually a really interesting institution because it's a set of norms that the Election Commission thinks that parties should obey to or adhere to, and parties agree to do that. These norms are in some ways, if you compare to what can be said during an electoral campaign in America, are extremely stringent. So things you can say here and get away with, you can't do that if you go by the Model Code of Conduct in India. Because of just the fact that it can start a conflict. But those violations have happened. The Election Commission at times has not been found. As Shilita was saying, that the things that it hasn't done has been a problem. On electoral bonds, I would just point out that the Electoral Commission had taken a stance against the electoral bonds. That case was pending in the Supreme Court. It took a long time to hear that case and to decide on it. And now it's been discontinued. And so if you were going to think about, putting blame on someone, I think that ball is in the Supreme Court's, it's with them. It's not so much the Election Commission, because the Election Commission did oppose the program when it was first instituted and even proposed. So, but we need to understand these things in the context of how power is distributed in India and in the parliamentary system that it has. This is very much a moment of executive dominance that we've seen in the past. And what we are seeing in terms of institutional performance, especially the fact that some of the referee institutions are not working the way we expect them to do, and the way they have done in the 30 years between starting the late 80s until 2014, that departure is because of the strong executive that we see in office now. And the pendulum has swung one way. It could very well swing the other way. That's been the nature of Indian politics.
Yeah. And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today's show, we're talking about India's elections, how India conducts an election, some of the key questions that has been raised in this election. Our guests are Amit Ahuja of UC Santa Barbara, Sandeepto Dasgupta of the New School, and Ritu Mather of University of Texas San Antonio. And in this last section, I want to talk about the likely outcome and what this means for India. And Ritu, I'm going to ask you first, since you're a fellow international relations scholar. India, since its independence, has sought to position itself as a leader of the developing world, the third world, the global south. We've changed those names in many different ways. And in many ways, Prime Minister Modi has achieved even a sort of greatness, a sort of position that Jawaharlal Nehru and Indira Gandhi, Rajiv Gandhi had sought, but weren't able to accomplish. So Modi right now, my understanding, it had the highest approval ratings of any G20 leader and is expected to win. How much is this election likely going to serve as a bit of an affirmation of how popular he is in India and really position him not just as an incredibly powerful executive within India, but a real world leader with some real ability to project India's power?
Just to add a little bit what Amit was saying earlier and Sudipto also, these elections are Lok Sabha elections, right, which is the lower house of the Indian parliament. And this is where the voices of the Indian people actually is really represented. So it's a very, very important elections. And you need to win 272 seats to form a government, right? Just for people, for audiences, I'm just laying this out over here. The BJP in the last election actually had a majority, 303 seats, and now they're trying to get 400 plus seats. Now, with regard to how we should be responding to this particular election, what should be the question we should be asking? One thing, as an international relations scholar, I would like to point out very quickly, and with what Amit also said, is that religion, caste, you know, ethnic rivalries, this is how the developed countries often tend to look at the domestic politics within developing countries. And India is no exception to this rule. And although, as Amit mentioned, we've had 30 years of coalition governments in which caste politics, religion politics, all played a very, very important role. But this was never the central question which was always being asked over here. But this, so this big question of the West constantly asking India to respond in terms of, oh, you know, how is the caste politics played out? How is the religion politics being played out? Please understand that even the Indian population is getting tired of these particular questions. They are interested. If you're really interested in India's growth, India's developmental agenda, then questions with regard to women's empowerment, questions with regard to access to basic utilities, healthcare, education, you know, these are very, very important issues. And these are the issues basically on which the Indian public feels that the Modi government is delivering. And these are the issues which should be debated in terms of whether, how much did they deliver, what were the means of delivery, etc. Was there any kind of monopoly in terms of the delivery of these particular, you know, social welfare schemes, etc. This is what should actually be debated. Right. So the question over here is like, does the West really want to see a powerful democratic India emerge and talk to India about its growth and about its development in a sense, rather than always talking in terms of caste, religion, ethnicity, etc.? This is very, very important. I would like to point it out. And second thing is also the whole thing is that, you know, India is also this whole thing, the part of the BJP electoral manifesto is that India is now the fifth largest economy and now we want to make it the third largest economy, right? India has basically this, you know, this whole digital sovereignty. India wants to safeguard its digital sovereignty. And so the Indian people want to understand this, want to respond to this with regard to employment opportunity. Yes, that is a question which interests the Indian youth. The Indian youth is not so much interested anymore in terms of religion and caste politics. They are interested in terms of how will the development of AI, will it provide them with jobs? Will it take away their jobs, etc.? What about the Indian H-1B visa people who are being sent back in a sense, right? In that sense, what about their opportunities, etc.? These are the questions which people want to engage with. India's defense policy, that is very, very important. India's military alliances, the weakening of Russia, India being in a sense, India being used to some extent to contain China, right? These are the questions which people in India are interested in responding to. And that is where part of the manifesto of these political parties also should be taken into account. So I'll just stop over there. I'll give others a chance. Thank you.
No, absolutely. And Sandeepto, because the BJP is expected to win, it seems like the only question is, you know, how many seats they're going to win. At least part of this narrative, we've talked about it some, but I want to be explicit here. I mean, is this the death knell of Congress? Congress going to be able to recover? It's been such a long time since Congress, you know, has been really competitive with the BJP, and anybody following Indian politics, that has been one of the most striking national political issues, is just how weak Congress has been via the BJP. Is this election going to mean that whatever emerges from Congress as a challenge to the BJP, if it does emerge, has to be something quite a bit different than where it currently is?
So no, this has been a question amongst people sort of who are on the other side of BJP within Indian politics for a long time, whether Congress is a hindrance or a help in this battle. First of all, the decline of Congress is, you know, it's a long-term process, and partly it is because Congress has always been sort of a coalitional party. And I mean, internally, this is sort of the earliest sort of political science work in India, which is that it's not an ideological party, it's a coalitional party, right? In other words, it sort of had space for all different groups. That's harder to maintain out of power than in power. And so I think there has been, and this sort of general ideological weakness in Congress also led to an over-dependence on one particular family, which, you know, correctly Therefore, it's a question of the dynastic rule, and they still haven't been able to completely sort of shake themselves out of that, right? So those are kind of the long-term weaknesses of Congress as a party, which has been there for, you know, a while now, right? Having said that, if Congress still commands a significant, you know, number of votes, it has, and more importantly, I think it has an organizational base across all the states in India, right? And those are things that don't just go away, right? And those are things, and so that's part of the question some people have had, is there a way of remorphing it into something else, which, you know, then it's just Congress a different name, or is there a way Congress can, so I think they have tried over the last couple of years to sort of rebrand themselves as much more of kind of this old school sort of democratic kind of party, talking about, you know, because one of the sort of topics we haven't talked about at all in this program is, this is the, you know, there's reports, including one by Thomas Piketty recently, of India's inequality, which is staggering. It is, it's worse than it was during the colonial era. And it's only become much, much worse in the last 10 years, right? Where the top 1% of the country owns 40% of the national wealth. And that's higher than the US, which is already quite an unequal country. And so Congress has tried to make an economic argument against the more sort of, you know, religion and religious inflected argument, which is that of the BJP, but they lack in, because they don't really, it's not a cadre based party. They don't have a strong, you know, roots on the ground. Those the left parties which used to have that till even the 70s and 80s are quite weak. They're only in one state really. So what lacks against the BJP, I think, is a pretty solid, well organized, ground based party. Which the BJP itself is. It is a, you know, enormously well-organized party. It has cadres on the ground, people, you know, part of a larger social movement. And that just, on the other side, you have are these regional party formations. They're quite strong in their own region. But you don't have a sort of a counter ideological formation, which real strength in the ground. So Congress has the sort of the skeleton of a party, which is, you know, quite extraordinarily large and diverse and was in power for the longest time. But it doesn't have, can't match BJP in that capacity. So they're stuck in this kind of position of whether they should disband this entire thing or try to rebuild something out of that skeleton. And I don't think there is necessarily a very good answer. There's a lot been written on this question.
Ritu, you had something you wanted to add as well.
The Congress definitely had a very strong organizational base within the country, but, you know, ever since Rahul Gandhi's leadership, basically, it has totally fallen apart. And the fact of his complete lack of confidence in his own leadership, you know, so in a sense, his constituency, whether his own ability to get re-elected is within his own constituency, is constantly being questioned over here. Another thing is that, yes, Congress is always forming these coalitions, and this whole idea of this Indian National Development Inclusive Alliance, India as the opposition. They basically used India's name and created an opposition party in itself, a coalition in a sense. But even within that coalition, if you look at the dynamics for the last year and a half, it's been a complete joke with regard to distribution of seat sharing, with regard to even getting the manifesto together, right? They could not even get TMC, Mamata Banerjee's party, to agree to join the manifesto. I think the greatest disservice which this particular family has done over a period of time is not giving this beautiful party which was there a chance to grow. It's total alienation now from this particular political party, and even the top leadership of that political party, you know, Maulana Azad, etc., all of them in a sense leaving this party, is showing that basically it has totally lost its focus. And Rahul Gandhi coming overseas, right, and criticizing the Indian military services, that was basically the last straw for many Indian people, right? Because at least on one part, which, yes, you might have a lot of differences domestically, but then coming overseas and criticizing the Indian armed forces, right? Using that as a leverage point against the mainstream party, that was actually not acceptable to many, many Indians.
And Amit, what do you see is the future of India after this elections, ultimately the core takeaways from this election?
So I think, you know, one thing that you have to acknowledge now, having seen Mr. Modi in action for two tenures, that he is a once in a generation mobilizer. He's extremely skilled. He is an extremely talented politician. The way he's been able to connect across India is unparalleled. There is no one else in Indian politics today who can match that skill. Irrespective of what you may think of his ideology. at its disposal, the BJP does have a remarkable structure. It is the best organized party in India. One way or the other, the BJP is going to come out in front. I'm not going to stick my neck out and, you know, predict to what extent. Let's assume that it is going to be the governing party for the next 5 years, and Mr. Modi is going to be in the prime minister's seat. I think this is going to be a very challenging 5 years for him, just because of the way things are. And essentially, the unemployment issue is very acute, especially not just overall unemployment rates, which people have put between 25% to about 40%, but it's the educated youth unemployment rates, which are really worrying. And I think he is aware of that. And so there is something that would have to be done immediately to figure out ways to deal with that pressure. I think the threat of China will loom very large. What happens in the American elections will have an implication on what happens with respect to Taiwan. That has serious security implications for India. Security implications of the China threat, in some ways, India has been able to avoid until now. It's not hidden from it. It's the only country that is, you know, in eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation with Chinese soldiers. But the fact is, it has definitely tried to avoid conflict, but conflict may be forced on it. And that's something that Mr. Modi will have to deal with. And then, of course, you know, there will always be the challenge of managing a large economy and dealing with conflicts across a large country. So I don't see this in the next 5 years as a comfortable stint for him. It's going to be very challenging.
And with that, our panel today has been Amit Ahuja. He is Assistant Professor of Political Science at UC Santa Barbara. He's the author of Mobilizing the Marginalized, Ethnic Parties Without Ethnic Movements. Sandipto Dasgupta is Assistant Professor of Politics at the New School for Social Research. He's the author of Legalizing the Revolution, India, and the Constitution of the Post-Colony. And Ritu Mather is a new full professor of international relations at the University of Texas, San Antonio. She is the author of Civilization Discourses in Weapons Control. Thank you all very much for sharing your time and your expertise with us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.